Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, July 11th, 2013. Can you believe it's already July?
The summer's over, brother.
It ain't over up here.
No, I don't mean the temperature, but I mean the tourism stuff. I mean, it's just a few more weeks and it's done.
They go back to school around here starting the 31st of this month.
Oh, come on, Bobby.
Yes, sir. Some of them go back the 31st, and then the rest of them go back the following week.
Well, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, we haven't had but maybe what you'd really call hot days, maybe four or five all summer, really.
Yeah.
I mean, no 100 stuff or 99.
I got water standing in my yard up here because there's so much water in the ground, it's got nowhere to go.
But
it rained again today.
It did. At least you hadn't got a water. That girl said on that opening of the show that we paved the way. I want to cut.
I heard that, brother. I heard that. You know, we
maybe.
What was me, Bobby?
Before the show went on, Jerry asked me if I had seen that Randy Orton, God love him, was getting a divorce, and it's tough when true love goes away. But if those figures were right, I believe if I remember right, they said he made $299,000 a month.
Yes, sir. $291,000, what I saw.
$291,000. I knew it was $290,000. Hey, when you got that much money, what difference does it make? You know, six or seven here or there. But geez, I mean, they're talking about splitting up houses and bank accounts. And
Bobby, our world champions didn't make that much, did they?
No. No, 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 no.
Well, what'd Jack make, like 250?
Probably. You know, I mean, I don't know exactly, but yeah, probably in that neighborhood.
But that's a lot of money then, I guess.
Yeah.
A lot of money now.
A month? Working 4 days a week?
That's all they work, you're fat.
Yeah. I mean, I just got a sneaking suspicion some of them top dogs ain't making these little shows in Podunk, Mississippi.
Well, not only that,
no.
But you figure, what does an average match last now? 6-8 minutes? Break that down by minute, what they're making.
But I was thinking about it today. Let's just say, like him, for example. At the max they would work would be 16 times a month, at the max. That's 4 times a week.
Yep.
And you divide 16 into that total, and you see what it is about.
When I started,
I don't know.
You started a little bit before I did. When I started, the guarantee in Georgia was $15.
Well, when I started, it was 25.
Okay.
That was when Gonko was here. Still
okay.
Alive.
Well, I know with Ann, it was 15. That was a guarantee when I started. And now I was on salary. When I first went to work for her, I went to work for the whopping sum of $65 a week. But
I know you just made that up.
No, that's fact. $65 a week, and she paid my expenses, though. So, you know, my foot got in the door. I'd have done it for $50 a week.
I know.
Got my foot in the door. And you know, that was, I mean, being perfectly honest, that was what it was all about for me at that point in my life. And I was working for Southern Bell for $105 a week. That's what Southern Bell paid back then in 72. And I resigned Southern Bell and took that for $65 a week, and that's probably the closest I ever come to my mother having a stroke.
Over I didn't know you worked for Southern Bell. I never knew you worked for them.
Worked for them for 3 weeks.
What was you doing, Bobby?
I was working as worked on a frame inside the buildings where the installer would go out and hook it up in the house. I hooked it up to the frame inside the building.
He was a cable splicer.
Pretty much.
But let me tell you something. This is just, this is a wrestling show. We talk about wrestling sometimes. But on today's market, any of these boys wind up broke, I have no sympathy. I can't.
Well, you got to figure how much money Flair made all those years, and he doesn't have a dime unless he borrows it. Of course, he's got five or six ex-wives, and don't tell him how many bartenders he supported.
Well, you know, I like Rick. I got nothing against Rick. Me and Rick never had a crossword. Me and him got along. I ain't seen him in years. But Rick was of the mindset he had to live that lifestyle he was talking about. And that's where his money went. Sorry, but that's where it went. Plus the ex-wives and the, you know, whatever else. But, you know.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing with him. I mean, he was out there for so long, he had to see the handwriting on the wall. Sooner or later, this is going to end.
You would
I
think
don't think
so.
He's seen it yet, to be honest with you.
I think you're correct.
He's reached a point in his life where he did not plan for the end of it. There's nothing else he can do. Where's he going to go? What's he going to do? Who's going to hire him? You know, he's worked so long that people. People are laughing at him. I mean, you know, everybody I see that mentions him, they go, why is he still doing this? You know.
Well, he's not doing it now, is he?
I don't think so.
Well, he's back. I think he's under contract with Vince again, but I think it's one of those Legends things.
Legends contract,
He's still doing autograph signings mainly now. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago when he was still climbing into the ring, had the business not changed to the drastic end that it did, you know, there were always guys like that, Spider Galento, Fred Blassie, guys like that who J.C. Dykes, when they reached a certain point, they became a manager and added another, you know, 10, 15 years of their career. And there was places for guys, because Flair, you know, as far as I know, still has the charisma and the mouth that he'd have been a perfect manager back in the day.
But I heard that he was offered a job up there when he retired. He wouldn't take it.
As doing what? Road manager or something?
Whatever. I can't say for sure. But he wanted to be in the ring still. That's when he went to TNA.
Not only that, but he can't manage himself, much less other people.
I understand that. That's a good thought there. You know, it's sad. It's really sad, and you know, I just can't imagine being him. I mean, I don't know.
Well, it's like Bobby said. He's done it so long. He doesn't know what else to do.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't. He has no. I mean, he wouldn't know. I mean, like I say, I don't know him anymore because I haven't seen him in years. But I feel sorry for him to some degree because, you know, it's like I told Scrappy McGowan this a while back. I said, I'm as proud of you and me as anybody I know in this business. I said, because when we saw the writing on the wall, and the writing on the wall for me was, I just got tired of running a daycare center for adults. I mean, I you know. If you asked Ole, he fired me. If you asked me, I quit. You know, whatever happened. I got a job. You know, I've been where I'm at 28 years. And, you know, it's just, I got pictures on my, you know, for years and years and years I wouldn't talk about it. I still had that kayfabe mentality. I didn't tell people what I did. If somebody recognized me, I'd talk about it a little. But it, you know, now I got pictures on the wall. People come in, and I was never ashamed of it. I'm proud of it now. I've come to grips with it that, you know, I had a good run. I think I was good at what I did. I think I was an asset, you know, as far as, you know, to the people I worked with, that nobody had to be afraid I was going to kill them. And I just, but these guys that just never, you know, I mean, it's not only Flair. You know, you look at these independent shows that these guys are still going to.
I know. It's almost like a disease. It's hard to shake.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it's Harley Race told me one time, and he said this. We were in Vegas this few years ago, and he said once you're under the spotlight, he said it never goes away. You always want to be there. You know, and that's true. Just like I was talking to you when you went to that show, knowing you sit there and thought, I can do that better than they can. Until you move and your knees go, no, you can't. Or your back says, no, you can't.
And you I don't know. It's hard to walk away from. I mean, but I'd hate to think I still was doing it or trying to do it. I mean, I guess I could get booked here and there, but I'd be a fool. I mean, I wouldn't embarrass myself. You know what I'm saying?
The last time I refereed, I couldn't hardly walk for 2 weeks. My knees kill me. And I said, this is insane. I said, why am I doing this? And I just, every time somebody had asked me after that, I'm retired.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to
I guess in a way, it's good that there's still an audience for people of our era and before. Those that are able, but to, you know, go sign autographs, go sell pictures, you know, do that, make appearances, but don't get in the ring.
No.
Vince calls and offers me $299,000 a month, I'll just buy me a case of Advil, and me and my knees will just pack our bags.
If he offered me for that 1 month, I think I could pull it off for a month. I'd have to have total body surgery.
Oh, geez.
I can't even fathom that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Somebody posted somewhere on the net a list of 10 or 15 of their workers and their guaranteed contracts, what they call worst-case scenario contracts, the bottom line of what they'll get just for showing up. And they range everywhere from $75,000 for some of the guys that are, you know, mid-card tag team, all the way up to CM Punk, who's $1.9 million. And that's not including their T-shirts, the cut of their T-shirt sales and all that stuff. They get anywhere from 3% to 6% of that, depending on who they are. So they're raking in money.
1983, 1984... I can't remember the year after I quit. I can't remember if I quit in 82, 83. I think I quit in 83. I don't know. But anyway, the following December, I quit in the December, and the following December, Barnett called me. And he was working as the controller for McMahon. And he just called before Christmas. He just called, shooting the bull, Merry Christmas, blah, 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 and we were talking. And he said, Mr. Bobby, he said, I'm fixing to do something I've never done in, as long as I've been in the wrestling business. And I said, what's that? He said, I'm fixing to write a wrestler a check for $1 million. And I said, you're kidding. I said, for what? And he said, that was the royalties that Hogan made that year on the cartoons, T-shirts, gimmicks, whatever it was he sold. That wouldn't count what he made working. That was his royalty off the gimmicks. And that was in December, I want to say 84. I mean,
I bet Steve Austin surpassed that.
No, I bet he did too.
Oh, I'm sure. I bet neither one of them any of them probably didn't have a punch drunk boxer selling their stuff for them. What was his name, Jerry?
Michael, he just went deadly silent on the other end there, bro.
He dropped the phone and walked away.
Still have nightmares. But anyhow, I don't begrudge him. I mean, I really don't, you know. Of course, the money's there, and, you know, if it's there, you should get it, you know.
You got to take it, yeah. I mean, it beats, you know, working old-school mat wrestling in a gym in front of 15 people and getting a ham sandwich.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Or
cutting yourself up with a weed eater.
Oh, geez.
I wish Bo James had never sent me that.
Wasn't it sick? I mean, I couldn't believe it. It's like watching a train wreck. You know it's not good, but you have to watch it if you see it. I mean, it's like, you know, geez.
I'll never watch it again.
Yeah, I mean, and then that led to the light bulb thing. I mean, yeah, I just...
Oh, my gosh. They go die with some kind of...
Somebody, Kyle Matthews sent me one, and he said this is he sent it to me, and he said this is a 6-minute match. He said watch it at about the 4-minute mark, and I watched it. I had it in my computer. I was at work. I popped it up on a computer, and I'm sitting there watching it, and I was half paying attention to it. When he got about the 4-minute mark, I watched. I swear I'm telling you the truth. This guy popped a box opener up, you know, like a. You know what I'm talking about?
Box cutter.
He opened that thing up and stabbed the guy he was working with in the arm.
Bobby Sherman.
I swear I'm telling you the truth. They had the camera where it would catch it all. I mean, I watched this guy's skin open up, and I'm like, this is insane. What are these people thinking?
How many people
really
are in the audience?
Know.
Maybe 60.
You know, and there's 15 people in the building. You know they ain't making no money. They're just going to go to work the next day and talk about how bad they got beat up and how bad they bled. And, I mean, you know, McMahon has successfully told the whole world it's work, that, you know, you're not fighting. So, I mean, I just don't know what this accomplishes.
I don't either. That shows you the mentality of what's out there.
Yeah.
I guess it's a good thing that they love the business so much that they're willing to do that, but at the same time, they're loving the wrong end of it as far as I'm concerned. I mean, what happened to learning to wrestle?
They don't know nothing about the business. All they know is, I mean, yeah, that's... I don't know where, on the Cauliflower Alley Club website, there is a interview, somebody interviewed Nikita Koloff, and... He told how he got in the business, and they asked him, you know, how he learned. And I thought it was a very interesting line. He said he was a quick learner. He said he was a good student, which I agree. But he said, I learned the most riding in the car and sitting in the dressing room listening to Ivan Koloff and Don Kernoodle tell me what and why they did stuff.
Well, you can tell these idiots know nothing.
No, they don't want to know. They know it all.
Well, they learned it all on Monday night, sitting in front of a television. You were probably surrounded by future wrestlers when you went the other night, Jerry. Those guys sitting in the second row watching everybody jump off the ring rope said, I can do that.
Yeah.
Scrappy. I may have told you this, Jerry. I don't know if I did or not. Scrappy told me this. He said that he went down one Saturday night to work for you when you were running your thing there in Columbus. And he said the first match, and I don't know who the people were. He didn't give me any names, but he said the first match, he said one guy was running late. He said he had called, and you knew he was running late, and it was okay. And he said you told Scrappy and the other guy, I said, just go out there and do a 15-minute Broadway. I said the guy came in, and he was getting dressed right quick, and Scrappy said he looked over at him. He said, we're just going to do a 15-minute Broadway. He said, well, okay. And he said, you came back through and told the guy the same thing. And said, just before they went to the ring, said the guy called Scrappy over to the side, and he said, Bubba, he said, don't embarrass me in front of Jerry and nobody. He said, but what's a Broadway? I love it.
Yeah, it's
a street it's where Jack Dempsey's restaurant is.
Yeah, really.
Charlie was doing the ring announcing one night, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, this is your first match. It'll be a one-fall, 15-minute Broadway.
People probably watched that match closer than any match that night, trying to figure out what the difference was.
What the Broadway was.
That's what a Broadway was. They went through the whole 15 minutes, and I didn't see anything special at all. What's a Broadway?
The funniest thing ever happened to me with that was I went to Hoganville. Some guy was promoting a show down there, and Ted Allen called, and he said, if they want a referee, will you go? And I went, yeah. And I got down there, and they had more referees than they had wrestlers. And the guy come in there, and he said, look, he said, I'm going to pay you what I promised you. He said, but would you just do one match and be satisfied? I said, look, Bubba, I said, you pay me half of what you promised me, and I don't have to do none. And he said, no, he said, I want you to do one match. He said, well, you do the first match. And it turned out to be Ted Allen and Mike Jackson. So I knew it would be a decent match, you know. So we told us, he said, how about doing a 15-minute Broadway? I said, no problem. We went out there and got in the ring, and the ring announcer said, ladies and gentlemen, it's your first match. It'll be one fall with a 20-minute time limit. And when he said 20 minutes, Jackson, Ted, and myself all at the same time went, 20 minutes?
Oh, man. Well, you did a 60-minute Broadway with Edie, your retirement match, didn't you, Jerry?
Me?
Yeah. Wasn't it you and Bo against Ted Allen and Edie? They
no. No. It was me and Ted and Bo Oates against Vordell Walker, Greg Brown, and Ted Allen.
Okay.
Oh, that was what you're talking about is the one Smitty, where you had Smitty come down to Columbus to be a special referee. And it was you and somebody against, you had brought the superstar down that night, Bill Edie again, somebody. And Smitty said, y'all went in a little room to talk. Said, you told everybody, said, I think we're going to do a 60-minute Broadway tonight. Said, anybody here can't do it? And Charlie said, well, I'll do it. And he said, everybody else kind of looked and said, Bill Edie held his hand up and said, I can't.
I wouldn't. I look back at those, and I don't even know how I did those.
Oh, jeez.
But you know, if you got a great referee and two good workers, there's nothing like it.
Yes.
And it takes three to do it.
The only serious diet, I should be on one now, but the only serious diet I ever went on in my life, I decided I was going to drop some weight. So I worked at Augusta on Monday night, and the main event was, I don't even remember who it was, but they won an hour. And they used to have an old scale that sat right there by the doors. You come down them steps out of the dressing room, and I went and weighed myself. And I went down there and worked. The match went an hour. And I don't remember who it was, but you know how they go. When I come out of the ring that night and I made it back up the steps, that scale, I stopped and weighed myself. I lost 9 pounds in an hour.
I don't doubt it.
Just sweating.
Yeah, because, I mean, can you imagine Funk Jr. and Briscoe, all those 60-minute Broadways they worked night after night after night after night for months and years on end?
Well, y'all saw where Matt Bourne died. Did y'all ever, either one of y'all know him?
Yep.
Yeah, I saw that. But the last I heard, and I hadn't heard any more about it, they were talking about investigating it as a homicide. But then I never heard any more about it, so I don't know what the deal was.
I met his dad. But I never met him.
I met his dad when I went with Charlie to a reunion out in Seattle, and I met his dad out there.
Yeah, I met his dad in Portland.
He had a part of that office, didn't he, Gary?
Not when I was there.
I know that's where he made his name, between there in Texas.
He told me a story when we were out there. He said that him and Tiger Conway Sr. was the first integrated match where you had a white wrestle a black in Houston, Texas. And he said they liked to have a riot.
Tony Bourne was over out in Texas now, I'm going to tell you.
He said nobody wanted to do it, and he agreed to do it. He said it was a warm deal.
I bet it was.
I can imagine so. The Tiger was the baby face, wasn't he? Tony normally worked heel.
Yeah.
Right.
Amazing how much the world has changed, isn't it?
I remember, here again, just as a kid going to the matches, but I heard Renesto talk about this. Tom and Jody were the Tom was Hispanic, but they were the first light-complected wrestlers to ever wrestle a black guy in the city of Atlanta. They wrestled in a tag match against Bobo and somebody.
Really?
And he said they got all kinds of death threats and everything else. I don't remember a whole lot about that era coming up. I mean, as far as things that were happening, but I can remember as a kid going downtown Atlanta and there seeing water fountains and bathrooms with, you know, whites only and blacks. I can remember that.
Oh, I remember that too.
Yeah.
Well, it may have been before your time, Bobby, but I know our friend Chuck Thornton has talked about the City Auditorium in Atlanta. The black fans could only sit up in the balcony.
That upper balcony, yep.
Yep. It was the same way in Memphis until Sputnik got there.
Yeah. I've heard Burrhead tell stories about down in Alabama and Mississippi and that they couldn't eat in restaurants together. He'd have to go around going the back door through the kitchen to eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the guys would, you know, say, hey, we ain't going to stop here if you ain't going to feed him. And he'd say, no, we all got to eat. And he'd go around back. Because I know a few years ago at the reunion, we got together on a Thursday night at a Mexican restaurant across the street. And they had us upstairs in a banquet room, but we were in the back part of the banquet room. And we went up the steps, and the lady told Burrhead, said, all the way in the back. He screamed loud as he could. He said, you know, we in Alabama, some things never change. Burrhead, go all the way to the back.
Well, Burrhead was known about saying stuff like that in the middle of a match, too, to get you in trouble.
Oh, please. Well, you know, one thing I can honestly say about the wrestling business, I don't know if Jerry ever ran into it. I don't ever remember running into a time where, I mean, guys didn't look at guys as black or Hispanic or Puerto Rican or what. I mean, they were just one of the boys.
I never sensed that either, Bobby. Never did.
I didn't either.
Never did. Except when Murdoch was around.
Well, the Mahler and Homer Odell. I was telling somebody about them the other day that when Brute Bernard and Homer and Kamala were all together in the Crockett territory. You know, they all were the way they were, but then they worked with guys like, of course, they couldn't do it if they wanted to, but they worked with guys, and somebody said, well, why was that? And I said, because they looked at it, and they were just one of the boys. You know, there wasn't a black-white thing there.
Yeah.
And the Mobile territory, I mean, we never had more than two blacks working in the territory at the same time. Of course, that was in the 60s and 70s. That was pretty much every territory that was that way. There wasn't that many black wrestlers in the business at that time. But
whatever happened to Tom Jones?
He's in Texas or Oklahoma City, but he was sick for a while, I had heard. He was in his health. It was not doing well, but I haven't heard anything in the last several months. But he was either in Oklahoma City, Jerry, or in Texas, and he had his own little territory and a school out there up until the last year or so. And like I said, the last I heard, he was had some health problems, and I mean, that's like I said, that's been at least a year ago, and I haven't heard anything since then.
Tom's got to be on up there now.
Yeah, because he's older than you, because he started in the late 50s, I think.
Did he really?
Yeah, because I know I've got some early to mid 60s stuff on video from Bruiser's territory, and he's working there. And I've got one probably even earlier than that, probably 63, 64 from Toronto TV, and he's doing a job for the Sheik. So, yeah, he was, and of course, you know, the late 60s, and talking about integration, he and Tarzan Baxter were the first integrated tag team in Oklahoma, and from McGurk. They didn't
that's
allow
right.
integrated tag teams, and that was 67, 68 or so. But he worked a long time because he was still working in the late 80s in Texas under Hood as Mr. Ebony. Or he was either there or Portland. He may have been in Portland, too, with that gimmick. But he worked a long time.
Well, they had him, last time I seen him when he was in here, they had him teamed up with Pork Chop Cash.
Yeah, that was 74, 75, I think.
Yeah, around 75, I guess, because I didn't go to work for Barnett's office till November of 74. But, yeah, they were a team here.
What's Thunderbolt doing in Atlanta, Bobby?
Nothing I know of. He runs... He tries to do these shows at these churches on a religious type basis, but every time he does a show, I don't hear anything about doing any comebacks, so I don't know what that deal says, but I don't know. I don't know what he's doing other than that. Last time I saw him was
Facebook, Jerry, you need to be his friend on Facebook, Jerry.
I am.
Are you? He posts something just about every day. He misspells most of it, but you can get the gist of what he's talking about.
Yeah, last time I saw him was at the Ted Allen or the Nightmare to Remember show back in February.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah, that was a... kind of what a crazy time that was back when we were working with Ann and he come in here. Had nobody ever seen nothing like him. You know, he was so good on that microphone that, you know, and people just ate it up.
He can talk now.
Oh, yeah.
Here's what I was looking for, Jay. This is from February of this year. There's a story on here that our friend Greg Oliver did on his Canadian website that Tom was living in Tulsa, but they moved him in February to Amarillo, Texas, and put him in a nursing home. He's suffering from dementia.
Who?
Tom Jones.
He's in a nursing home.
Yep, he's in a nursing home in Amarillo. This is as of last February. February 2013. This is when Greg put this story up.
You're kidding me.
No.
In Amarillo.
In Amarillo, yeah.
Tom's got to be in his mid-70s, hasn't he?
I would think so. I mean, he worked, you know, almost 40 years. But it doesn't list anything in here as far as his age or anything, but... I would think, yeah, he's got to be at least there. Never met him, but I watched him work a lot of times. He was a great worker.
He could work. Always looked good. I think Tom was from Savannah.
That's where they used to say he was from.
I always thought he was from around Detroit, though. or even Canada, part of Windsor, Ontario, or somewhere. Because at least that's where he started. He may have been. I don't remember what they built him from when he was in Mobile. He came to Mobile a couple of times. He came in the late '60s when he couldn't wrestle a white man. He wrestled. Who was he wrestling? He was either Burrhead, before he was Burrhead, he was Jimmy Jones then, or it was, it was Matt Jewell. He made the rounds with Matt Jewell, Bearcat Brown later. And then he came back in the mid-70s. But I don't remember where they built him from.
Bobby, who was that Matt Jewell always worked with here in Georgia?
Oh, geez. You know, I see it all the time on the Georgia Wrestling History where they give the results for the days. I look at it every day, but I can't tell you his name right now. But they always billed him as the Georgia Heavyweight Champion, and they'd swap that belt back. You know, they'd one of them would win it, and then the next time they come through, the other would win it.
Right. They always
I don't, when you see them in Columbus, were they always the opening match?
Pretty much.
Yeah, see, that's where it was in Atlanta. They were always the opening match.
And where was Matt Jewell from?
Atlanta.
Yeah.
Really?
Matt Jewell, wasn't he? Ain't that Bearcat? Bearcat
Brown, yeah.
Bearcat Brown,
Bobcat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bobcat Brown's one. That's his brother that comes to Mobile. And he still lives here in Atlanta.
Maybe you're thinking of Sticky Samara, which was, of course, with Frankie Hester.
Did you ever meet Bearcat Wilkerson that worked with us over at Gunkel, Jerry?
Bobby, I don't know if I did or not.
Good guy. Him and Ted had some great matches. Him and Ted were about the same size, and they had that junior heavyweight division where they had Wayne Cowan and Ted and Bearcat Wilkerson and Al Velasco was the champ, and you know they had several people in that and that were about that size that you know they Dick actually started that junior heavyweight champion thing in Columbus, but you know Bearcat he couldn't read or write. He had about 13 kids, and he couldn't read or write, and he'd come outside the babyface dressing room and be standing there, and people come up and ask him for his autograph. He had a stamp pad and a stamp.
Come on, man.
Yes, sir. He would stamp
Come
in
on,
programs.
Man.
He'd stamp in programs.
I think I asked you 100 times about Al Velasco. Is he still around Atlanta?
We don't know where he's at. Can't nobody
Everybody
find
knows
him.
Where he is.
Can I find him?
Oh, I read today, too. I know we've talked about him in the past. I think you guys remember him. Henry Peluso, who worked in Georgia's Kublai Khan.
Yeah.
He died. He died back in 2006.
Oh, okay.
And they're just not finding out about it.
He was something else.
He was
what
funny.
Was his name?
Henry Peluso. He was from Mexico.
Henry Peluso. He was a nice guy.
We worked an outdoor show at a car lot up on Buford Highway here in Atlanta, middle of the summer. We set the ring up, and the show didn't start for a couple hours. They wanted to ring up early, you know, to attract people's attention. First match was him and somebody, and he went in that ring barefooted, and it burnt blisters on his feet. That thing was so hot.
Man.
Oh.
I can imagine. I had the advanced clowns with me the other day, and we were doing an outdoor show for a bunch of kids, and it was on grass, and that was hot enough. And one of the clowns was telling me they worked somewhere around Chicago with another circus a few years back, and the place they had them work was in a great big paved parking lot, and there was a pavilion. A covered pavilion there, and they were expecting the clowns to be under the pavilion to keep the heat off of them. And instead, you know, the clown said, "Well, look, we're not going to make all these kids sit out here in this hot sun." So they put all the kids out in the pavilion, and they worked a 30-minute show on that hot concrete.
Huh. Oh, jeez.
I thought to myself, man, can you? I can imagine what it was like working those outdoor cars on a ring mat. Mats were bad enough without getting them hot too.
Today, in looking at the results thing on Georgia Wrestling History, today was the anniversary of the show we did, the first show we did at Atlanta Stadium, where Stasiak worked with Wrestling 2 and Soto worked with Killer Brooks and a couple other matches. We did 4 matches. But today was the anniversary of that. They had 9 couples get married before the game, and then we had wrestling after the game, and Ted Turner called it wedlock and headlock. I'd love to get my hands on a copy of that. I bet it got destroyed, but we recorded all those matches.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, they said there was. Yeah, we flew Soli in. Soli set up in the press box and did the commentary.
Yeah, you think about all the film from all the territories over the years. What a gold mine it would be now.
Oh, please.
Jeez.
I mean, there's bits and pieces out there. I've got everything known of the Mobile territory that's been existing on video, and it's not very, it's 6-7 hours at the most. But I think of all those television matches that were filmed at Channel 3 in Pensacola, all those at Channel 17 before it was got on the cable, I know some people have some bits and pieces of it that they filmed either from the auditorium, 8mm stuff, or filmed the television. It turned out surprisingly well, but there's just, couldn't you just imagine? Someplace like Amarillo when the Fox had it. There's nothing out there that I know of. Nothing. Not 1 minute of it.
They don't have any of it either?
Not as far as I know. I mean, they just like every other territory, something? They taped over those tapes until they tore up, and then they threw them away. The rumor was that Holy had hours and hours up there in his attic up there in Tacoma, but I don't believe that's true either, or his garage or wherever it was, but I don't believe that's true either. But, Bobby Fields supposedly had a lot of Mississippi stuff. It was when they did tape the television in Hattiesburg, but none of that ever saw the light of day. And there's just so many angles that I saw growing up. And where Fred's stuff was all live, and nobody ever, unless they were trying to push an angle, was the only time they filmed anything from his shows. But just,
you mentioned Ole. Bobby, how is he doing?
Not good. He I don't even think he goes home on the weekend anymore. I think he's staying there in Monroe. He got him a little single wide trailer that he's living in so that he can be close to Marcia. Marcia's helping take care of him, and she takes care of her parents and I think her brother's children or something that she helps take care of, and I think her parents have gotten a little worse, and it's just got to the point where they don't even go to they don't even go up to Ole's on a weekend anymore.
He's in Monroe, Georgia.
Do what?
He's in Monroe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's where she's from, so that's where he's at. Charlie went up and worked a little independent show to sell his gimmicks last Saturday, and he said Ole came over for a while. So he didn't stay long, but he came for a few minutes. He probably saw one match and couldn't handle them more and left.
I'm sure.
We had, he's pretty much confined to a wheelchair all the time now, so.
That's hard to believe it.
Yes, it is. Never drank, never smoked, worked out all the time, and just, it all started because he fell off the house because he's too cheap to pay somebody to clean the gutters out.
Man, oh man.
You never know.
No, you don't, Mike. You don't know.
But you're talking about those videotapes and all that stuff. You know, I mean, the somewhere, I don't know where, there's got to be some of that Columbus stuff floating around. I mean, not floating around, but there's got to be that Columbus stuff. It's got to be down there somewhere in a barn, in a house, somewhere.
Ralph had tons of it.
And my understanding, Ralph still got it.
That's what I heard.
He's afraid to let it go because, he told me or he said something to the effect. Last time I seen him, which was in Mobile a few years ago, he said something to the effect was he's afraid to turn it loose because he's afraid that Vince, because he bought, you know, Georgia, might have grounds to sue him or something.
Well, I've got one disc.
I don't see that have nothing to do with nothing.
I don't either, but see, the thing is, Fred Ward Promotions was a totally separate entity.
Yeah.
Right.
But I don't know. But if, in fact, he's got that stuff, he's sitting on a gold mine.
I've got one disc of Columbus stuff, and it's either from 82 or 83, Jerry Euro on it, with a permanent. That's the best part of the tape. Jerry Euro with a permanent.
Don't let that be aired anywhere.
Those matches you're talking about is the ones you showed me, Michael. It was filmed at Auditorium, ain't it?
Yeah,
they were filmed at the old Columbus Auditorium. I don't know what they were doing filming there, but that's where they were at.
They
used
to film there,
Bobby. It's got voiceover and everything on it.
Yeah.
Well, Bobby, they had that. Remember Ralph got their own TV equipment, the truck
right.
And all? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, we were doing, for a while, we were doing TV on Tuesday here in Atlanta. Did you ever come up and do any of those?
Yes.
We'd come up on Tuesday afternoon, do a Merit Sports Arena, and they'd charge people $1 a pop to get in. There'd be 100, 200 people show up. And then we had Carlisle and somebody doing one desk, and then they put, I don't know who was on the other. But anyway, they were doing shows for Savannah and Albany, and we were doing them all at one time right there.
There was a lot of changes, wasn't it?
Yep. That was a fun, we talk about all them trips we made. That was a fun trip, too, to referee that, get through with that, and then have to go to Albany. Because we were running Albany on Tuesday night back then. If you was in Macon, it wasn't too bad. But if you had to go to Albany, you had to get on the ball.
What year was that, Bobby?
Jeez. 75 maybe, 76.
Okay. So I know, you were already gone, but when Vince took over and Ole started his own, he was filming the first couple of weeks. He filmed his TV. Didn't they film that in Columbus here? But they were filming on Fred's arena, TV arena?
I think so.
They did some of that stuff in Chattanooga now.
Yeah, I knew that too.
The studio up there.
I think that was after they were using Fred's. They only did it for a couple of weeks. And then they went to Chattanooga, and then they wound up back on TBS.
Well, Mr. Ward had a great TV set up in that old arena down there.
Yeah, well, it was a great arena.
Jeez. What did he charge the people to get in there? $2?
I don't know what it was, Bobby.
But he filled that place up every Saturday afternoon.
It was packed. It was packed.
Yeah, that arena, it surprised me the first time I went there. It was as big as the Expo Hall in Mobile. I thought they were filming TV in the area. But it was great. The production value was so much better than Mobile was when they were filming TBS. And I've looked, Bobby. I can't find your match of Mobile on film anywhere.
Well,
it burned it.
I think so. They probably got rid of it.
Even Terry Nathan trying to shoot on each other.
Randy Cully probably paid to get rid of it since he put me over on TV down there. He probably don't want nobody. He don't want nobody to know that.
Columbus has supposedly live TV left in the country.
It probably might have been.
I'm gonna tell you, there was a couple of Saturdays that I would come through that back door and I'd throw my bag over to that old fella that run the concession stand. And say, I'll be right back. And I'd go to the ring for the first match. I wouldn't have the foggiest idea what we was doing.
I know,
it was that
tight
close
run
coming from Atlanta TV.
That was a tight run.
And, you know, poor Ralph, I never quite understood until it was all over and I stopped and looked at it. You know, it ain't no wonder Ralph had ulcers and drank a little bit because, I mean, if you're sitting there with a live TV at 4 o'clock and Atlanta TV don't get over till 2 or 2:15, I mean, it was all you could do to make it.
It really was.
And they
weren't going to
pay for your speeding ticket, so, you know, you had to temper what you did with some good judgment.
It, a lot of guys didn't walk in until it was going on the air.
Yeah.
Soul Train will be playing, remember?
I think so. I tell my wife that all the time. I'll see Soul Train on one of these cable channels. I'll say, boy, that reminds me of Columbus.
It does, every time I hear it.
Yep. Sit in the restroom and watch Soul Train.
Bodang just sent me a text message and said Memphis was the last live. Because I know they ran 90 minutes live and then they cut the show down to an hour and bicycled it around to the rest of the territory. And that's what, when they started running it on like Pro Wrestling This Week, they got the cut down version, the hour version. But they ran live 90 minutes. But you were talking about those trips. That's why when I would have to go, or whoever I was, it was usually Jackson, we would have to go to Columbus TV. We showered and put our tights back on, our boots back on, and drove down there in our boots and tights because we didn't have time to change.
See, I never showered at Atlanta TV. I just went out the door and hit the road.
Well, I tried to be polite. I left earlier than you did, Bobby.
Yeah.
I watched that.
But those Saturdays, Bobby, wasn't a joke.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Because usually you left Columbus and had to come back up and do some spot show around Atlanta somewhere.
Well, we ran Griffin and Carrollton for years, and they were both about the same distance. Actually, Griffin generally was, you know, not a bad trip, but I preferred to go to Carrollton because somebody showed me how to go up 103, and there wasn't no traffic and there wasn't no cops. And you could fly up through there. All you had to do was blow the horn, wave at people, and she went by.
Well, I'm going to tell you, that Carrollton drew some money, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
I mean, for the time.
Yep.
That place would be jam-packed.
Yeah. Yeah. People that never went. The first building I went to over there when I started going was, I'm sure, the one you went to, which was by that lake, which was almost up into town pretty good. And the ceiling, if you took a big backdrop, your feet hit the ceiling.
That's it. That was the smokiest building I was ever in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's the one where the lights went out that night, and I got out of the ring, went under the ring. You know, he didn't have no emergency lights or nothing in there. It was just dark, and I got under the ring, and we started hearing. I started hearing something go pow, 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 pow. I got out he come down through there with Mr. Butler, the guy that run the place. He come down through there with a Coleman lantern, and I got out from under the ring when I seen the light and looked up, and them stupid people had started throwing folding chairs at the ring. And I didn't know where the two guys was, and they popped out from under the ring, too. And none of us knew the other was under there. If we'd have bumped into each other, it would have been the hardest fight you ever seen in your life. That's also the place I seen Ox Baker come out of the ring, and a lady took a cup of ice and just flipped it at him where it hit him in the back, about the rib cage. He went up on his tiptoes and took about three steps and broke in a run, hollering, "I've been cut, I've been cut."
No, he didn't.
Have you guys ever seen the video of the, it's on YouTube, it's match between Johnny Powers and Ernie Lay, or Johnny Powers and Baker, I can't remember what it was. But Ernie Ladd at the time was a baby face, or was a heel. And Johnny Powers turned from baby face to heel in that match. And it caused a full-scale riot from Cleveland. And you think Ox Baker was clumsy. He was agile jumping out of the ring and running that. Ladd came in to do a save on whoever it was that Johnny Powers turned on. But anyway, Ox hit him with 15, 20 heart punches and had him down on the mat, hit him with heart punches, and chairs are just flying into the ring. And Ox finally decides he better stop what he's doing and get out of the ring. That's the funniest thing in the world, watching him dive out of the ring, head for the dressing room with all those chairs flying at him. Maybe that's what you think. Randy Orton had earned his $291,000 a month, people throwing chairs at him. I guess it's a good thing those people don't grow the heat that they did back in our day. They wouldn't know what to do.
No.
Of course, they're so protected.
I mean, there's no heat anymore, you know? I mean.
No, everybody's there just to get seen on the big screen. The fans really aren't. If you watch a television program, most times fans aren't even watching the match. Of course, the announcers aren't talking about the match either. They're talking about what's going up on the next pay-per-view. And the fans are all looking at the Jumbotron to see, you know, if their sign shows up on there. And the clearest indication is now, if any time anything is going on in the ring, if the heels are beating down the babyface, and I don't know how you can tell one from the other anymore, but they're all standing up looking towards the dressing room because they know somebody's music's going to hit and somebody's going to do a run-in. That's how, you know, conditioned they are to how it works now. You can't fool them to save your life. I don't guess they even try to anymore. But out of all the stuff that the modern era does and the modern product, that's the thing that gets to me the most. When somebody does a run-in, they got time to turn their music on.
Yeah, really.
Especially if it's somebody who's been out of the off the scene, off television for 6 months to a year, all of a sudden they got time. I guess they brought their music with them and gave it to the guy in the production truck and said, "Here, I'm going."
Everybody
out.
Else does. Go to some of these shows. Here, who did I give my music to? Who did I give my CD to? You know, you're talking about fooling them or you know, maybe I'm the only one. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, Jerry, and I know Michael has. We've talked about it. I would like to be able to go back in time just for a few minutes to when I was a kid going to the matches, and I thought I knew what was going on, but I wasn't sure.
Of course.
And I still loved it.
Of course. That was the intrigue of it.
I loved it.
It was a mystique, Bobby.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I mean,
even when they got in the business, it was still a mystique.
When these guys, you know, you're talking about playing their music, you didn't have to play no music to get me ready for it. All you had to do was let me hear that bell ring at 8:30 on Friday night.
You have your hair standing up.
I was ready.
Well, if you're in Dothan, if it's 8:28, somebody, and if Greg Brown's listening, he'll know what this means. Somebody stand up and holler, "Ring the bell, Shorty."
Don't think they wouldn't do that.
Was the bell ringer down there. But let me ask both of you, taking you back, since Bobby brought it up as fans, what is the one thing when you think about when you were a fan, the one angle or incident that happened on television or whatever that sticks out most for you that either you even thought, well, that part of it's real or whatever, or just intrigued you so much. Is there any one thing, Jerry, that you can think of?
Like when I was in high school, I'd go down there and watch those assassins, you know, and I thought those were the meanest men on earth.
They were.
I was intrigued by what they did, how they did it, and what they did.
What about you, Bob?
I was impressed with them.
Yeah,
there's all kind of things that stick out in my mind. I mean, things that happened over the years. I had no idea what a hard way was. But I remember the first match Sputnik Monroe ever had at the City Auditorium in Atlanta. He worked with a guy named Guy Taylor, and he busted him open. And I had never seen that much blood in my life. And when Guy Taylor, when the match was over, when Sputnik finally pinned him, Guy Taylor got out, and rather than going toward the dressing room, he walked up the aisle toward the lobby, And I can still remember people scattering and screaming and running. I've never, I mean, I can just right now can see it in my mind the way this guy looked. And I mean, I
have
just,
you ever seen Guy Taylor since?
No.
I've never heard of him.
No.
Oh yeah, he worked quite a few places. In fact, he died in the ring in Minnesota doing a TV show for Vern.
You're
1966
kidding me.
Or 67.
Nope.
That
I didn't know that.
Yep.
It's funny. That's, I don't know what year Sputnik came to Georgia, but I can remember. I mean, I remember that like it was yesterday. I'll tell you another thing I remember seeing one time, and this was a, and I've heard this has been done a lot of places, but I'd never seen it done, hadn't seen it done since here in Atlanta. When Dick Dunn and Willie Garrett were in here as the Red Raiders, they were working a program with Enrique and Alberto Torres. And I remember one Friday night they were working the match, and I remember, and I don't know who was who at the time, but one of the Red Raiders jumped off the ring and ran back up the aisle to the dressing room while his partner was getting the crap beat out of him. And, you know, and, I mean, just no rhyme or reason. He just jumped down and left. And everybody's like, God, what's this all about? And a few minutes later, he comes back out. He comes back down to the ring, and he jumps up on the ring, and he's motioning, you know, he's trying to get the partner to, well, they finally make the tag, and he gets in the ring. And he shot behind whichever one of them, and he reached in his tights, and he pulled out a handkerchief and put it over the guy's face. Guy dropped down like he'd been knocked out. He covered him, 1, 2, 3. And I remember the next day on TV, they were talking about that they was looking into possible suspensions, that after reviewing the tapes of the matches, which they never taped the matches, they said they think that he had went to the dressing room and got some kind of ether or some kind of chemical. I mean, you know, just little things like that to plant ideas in people's heads. And I remember that from however many years ago.
Well, you remember they did that on Atlanta TV. Rock Hunter did that. And
Rock Hunter did that. Yes,
Gordon,
he did. I remember
Gordon
that.
Gordon brought the fans up there, and they were swearing they were smelling ether in the arena.
Oh, yeah.
And he probably no more had ether.
Yeah.
But they convinced themselves that they were smelling ether.
Yeah.
Well, the
they probably don't even know what ether smells like.
Yeah. The thing for me was, and it was so out of the blue, of course, most people know that Bobby Shane, the first territory he ever worked as a heel was Mobile. He had been in Georgia as a babyface, and when he contacted the office there and said he wanted to come in, he wanted to come in as a heel, and that's where he started the whole King of Wrestling gimmick and all this stuff. But his big thing was he refused to wrestle on TV because he said if he was going to wrestle, people were going to have to pay to see his body and all that stuff, you know, the whole job that he went through. But he had a running thing going with Lee Fields, as Lee was a promoter there. He hadn't wrestled in almost 10 years. And he would call him Leroy. And just out of the blue, they worked an angle where he slapped Lee on TV, and Lee just lost his mind and tore into him. And I'm sitting here watching this, and my nose is glued to the TV because Lee Fields, the only time you ever saw him, is he came out and changed something, put on a card coming up the next week. And then all of a sudden this happened, and I had no, my grandfather used to tell me what a great wrestler Lee Field was, and I had no clue. I'd never seen him work or anything. But that was so real that Lee's 13-year-old son, Ricky, who later got in the business but was not smart for the business at the time, came out there and went and was biting Bobby Shane on his leg on television. And that is the one thing, if there's any holy grail of footage, we've been talking about footage, if there's any holy grail of wrestling footage for me, I would love for that to show up in somebody's attic or basement, that film of that television show. And of course, that got my grandfather. That led to the first live card I went to. They booked a match two weeks out. Lee and Bobby Shane in the Municipal Auditorium, the big building, Bobby, that you thought you were going such a crowd. They actually sold it out, 10,000 plus people. And
that's unbelievable.
Well, Jerry, you worked in that building, so you know how big that building was.
Yeah.
10,000 people, Bobby Shane versus Lee Fields, and you're thinking the whole match, Lee's just beating him bloody, and you're thinking, well, Lee's going to win this, and then they did the swerve, and Bobby beat him. He ran himself, Lee ran out of gas, and Bobby pinned him. And they worked 6 months worth of matches. They worked
They carried that angle out for 6 months and only ran four matches and sold out just about every time the two of them were booked against each other. Hmm. But that television, I would love to see that. That's my memory as a child. Well, my grandfather, when he heard Lee Field was coming, Lee Field was his hero in the 50s when he used to go to the matches. And when he heard Lee
was
coming out
of the
fight,
he
went and saw it and took me, and that was my first card, first live event I ever went to.
Isn't that something?
Yep.
Well, I got a piece of video that was on something. You might have given it to me, Michael. I don't know, but I was going through it. I'm gonna take it Saturday and let everybody see it. I regret I never got Bill to see it because I wanted to aggravate him with it. But I got a match that was Atlanta TV where Armstrong and Dromo was teamed up together, and Armstrong did all the selling. And he gave Bill a hot tag, and he come in. And I forget who the guy was, but he was horrible. Bill comes in, gives him a couple of them haymakers, and goes to body slam him, and the guy don't help none. And all Bill can do to keep from killing himself is just let the guy roll over and roll Bill into a small package and just kill the comeback. Dromo got up.
And you do have that on tape, right?
Oh, I've got it. He got up. He just slapped Armstrong's hand with a tag and get back in there. I mean, just
I
killed
see
him.
That.
Just killed
I
him.
I can see that now.
I don't know if I gave you that or not. I'm trying to think if I've got that. I don't know if I've got.
I don't know. Somebody give it.
From
somebody
what,
give it to me. I pulled it off the tape and put it onto a DVD. So I've got it.
I know I've got some of Dromo back in the late 70s, early 80s, some of him and some of Rocky when they were pretty much working tag team matches and their partners did the job. I think Rocky was teamed with Carl Fergie quite a bit on some of the tapes I've got, and Fergie was doing the job on all of them. But,
I saw
yeah,
Bobby
again.
Brother.
Yeah,
I
talked to Jimmy.
Last I heard.
Talked to Jimmy Powell on Monday. We swapped emails. He talked to Bobby on Monday. He's out of the hospital. He seems to be doing a little bit better. And I told him, that we were thinking about him, praying for him. And he said, pass on his thanks to everybody that was saying a good word and putting in a good word for him. So he's, I think he's staying with his sister. So he's a little better right now.
Always like Bobby.
How's Joyce doing,
yeah.
Bobby?
Joyce is doing wonderful. I talked to Joyce on Monday or Tuesday of this week. She is staying at it's called the Hope House. It's a place Emory has. It's sort of like a Ronald McDonald House for adults. She'll be there for another 2.5 months, but the bone marrow transplant's doing good. She said that she was a little dehydrated. They had to give her some fluids and got on to her a little bit about drinking more water and more liquids, but other than that, she was doing fine. So
good.
She's doing good.
Well, that's good. Well, guys, on that high note, I think we'll end the show for this week.
Sounds good, guys.
We will be off for the next 2 weeks because I'll be tied up with circus business, but we will be back on Thursday, August 1st. I don't know where I'll be calling from. I won't be on Long Island anymore, but if I survive the 95-degree heat in the tent next week, the following week, it's always that way on Long Island. We hit Long Island, the temperature just spikes. I think we need to come in September or something. But anyway, that's the game plan at this point. I'll be calling from somewhere on August 1st, and we'll get together and everything. So hopefully I'll talk to you guys in between, I'm sure. But hopefully you guys have the next couple of weeks, and maybe
you too.
It'll quit raining in Georgia.
Well, you got Jerry. We're having a get together this Saturday. If you want to drive up to Atlanta, but I'll furnish fried chicken if you make it up here.
Well, I appreciate that.
I told Bobby I would leave here about midnight on Friday night, and
I'll have time just to swing by there. Somebody will stand out on the front porch and throw me a chicken leg on the, so I can make the U-turn and head right back to New York.
Well,
that's a long trip even for me.
I heard that. Well, we
listen, when it takes about 2 hours to get off, just to get off Long Island.
We maybe I can get some pictures posted. Everybody seems kind of excited. I think we're going to have a good turnout, and we're looking forward to it. So,
all right. Well, you guys have a good time. Tell everybody I said hello, and I'll talk
I'll
to you guys sometime in a couple of weeks, and we'll all get together on August 1st, and we'll do this again. So,
sounds good. Good night,
all right,
guys.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
For listening to The Strong Pack, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.